Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, North Coast Director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. During the last decades of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st, it became clear to all who would see that human impacts on the Earth's systems have led to profound changes in many of our planet's systems. Human impacts on the atmosphere led the Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen to coin the phrase the Anthropocene to describe a new geologic era, one shaped as much by human civilization as by natural processes. One of the most significant aspects of this emerging new world is the loss of species, a process that has a host of causes, but which often boils down to the destruction or degradation of the specific habitats a species requires to thrive and reproduce. The biologist Edward O. Wilson estimates that the current extinction rate is some 1,000 to 10,000 times higher because of human impacts. Indeed, there's substantial scientific consensus that if we continue on our current trajectory, half of all species on Earth will be extinct by the end of the 21st century. It's against this background that we consider today's topic, the U.S. Forest Service's latest proposal for a new set of planning regulations to govern national forest lands. Here in the U.S., much of the remaining habitat for a number of imperiled species is on public lands, especially national forest lands. Conservation groups have successfully fought three previous attempts by the Forest Service to introduce a new version of its planning rules, which were put in place by the Reagan administration in 1982. It is with no small pleasure that I introduce to KHSU's audience Andrew Orahosky, the new conservation director for EPIC, Humboldt's own redoubtable Environmental Protection Information Center. Andrew's trained as both a scientist and as an attorney. He's a graduate of the University of Colorado and of the University of Oregon's famed environmental law program. He's worked as a bird researcher here in Northwest California and in the tropics, and he's worked for the Center for Biological Diversity as an attorney. Welcome to the Eco News Report, Andrew. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be here today.
Excellent. So let's start with this idea of biological diversity. What is it, and why does it matter?
Yeah, the concept of biological diversity and biodiversity, as many people have shortened the phrase, it's an old idea. Simply put, it's life on Earth, all things great and small. It's really the celebration of all the evolutionary processes that have been occurring on this planet for 5 billion years.
So why does it matter to us, to humans?
Well, first off, we're part of that diversity of life. And while our current lives are very much apart from the rest of the biological diversity on this planet, we still depend on each and every piece of that puzzle, from the smallest microbe to great salmon runs to the food that we eat on the table every day. All of these things are part of what we term biological diversity.
So talking about the National Forests of Northwestern California, are they particularly important in terms of the conservation of biological diversity?
Absolutely. This region is considered one of the richest places on the planet in terms of number of species, as well in sheer abundance, particularly historic abundance of things like salmon. For example, the Klamath and Trinity systems once supported a salmon run that was so strong that it in turn supported one of the densest populations of grizzly bear or brown bear in the world. The bear is on our state flag, but nowhere to be found in our state anymore. And the area is, because of this, it's a highly productive ecosystems and its diverse landscapes. It really is a hotbed of biological diversity.
So how does the Forest Service protect biological diversity on national forest lands? What's the system, and how well is it working?
So the Forest Service initially had no plan to protect biological diversity on our national forests. It wasn't until the passage of several subsequent legislation, the National Forest Management Act really was in 1976, was the one piece of the puzzle that really made the Forest Service start to look at biological diversity and things other than getting timber out of the forest. Currently, the process is influenced primarily by the viability requirement in the regulations that have been put into forest plans. And the process is also very much influenced by the Endangered Species Act and consultation requirements under that act.
You talked about forest plans, and we should explain how a forest plan works and the relationship of a forest plan to this National Forest Planning Rule.
Of course. The forest plan requirement came out of the National Forest Management Act, and it mandated that each national forest come up with an overarching plan on how the lands in that particular national forest are going to be managed over a set time frame, preferably 5 to 10 years. In places, it's been much longer than that, where an individual plan has been in place. Contained within the plan are standards that they're sort of the backbone of what the plan really means on the forest, what it really means on the landscape. Each individual project, whether it requires a environmental impact statement and a lot of analysis or a categorical exclusion and very little analysis, must be in compliance with that forest plan.
And so at the top, you've got this national rule about how the plans are made, which is what's getting changed now. And then the plans have to comply with that, and then each individual project has to comply with the plan. So then we get to this idea of the viability rule, which you were talking about, which let's see if we can recite it from memory. It's the requirement that the Forest Service maintain well-distributed populations. No, I got it wrong already. And so then we get to the question of the viability rule, which you introduced a moment ago. What's that say?
Well, basically, the idea of maintaining viable populations of any species, which is contained in the 1982 regulations implementing the National Forest Management Act, to ensure that each species of wildlife or fish or plant or fungi is well distributed throughout the forest. There's this concept of developing a population viability model. For some species, the need is very great to ensure, and generally those species are also listed as threatened or endangered, but not always. For other species that are very common, this idea of viable populations is not one that requires a lot of thought, right? So where the rubber meets the road on this issue is when you have a species that may or may not be protected but is in bad shape, how does the Forest Service go about ensuring that that population will continue to exist? And for species that are really low and really having a tough time, how do those populations begin to be restored and recovered?
So this idea of viable populations could really matter for species like fishers, owls, salamanders, salmon that we have here in northwestern California.
Absolutely. There are some species, such as the spotted owl, that has Endangered Species Act protections. Others, such as the Pacific fisher, that is languishing in a candidate status and does not have the same protections. So in particular for the fisher, the viability requirement is very, very important. And I would say also that just because a species does get Endangered Species Act protections and it becomes listed does not necessarily mean the viability requirement in the NIFMA regs loses any importance whatsoever, because in the context of the Endangered Species Act, all of the decisions and all of the analysis is trending towards this idea of, are we jeopardizing the species with extinction? Are we talking about stamping this thing out for good?
Forever, ever, everywhere, yeah.
Which is a very reactive frame of mind to approach species conservation. The nice thing about NIFMA is it requires, perhaps, at least I would like to think, a more proactive approach in ensuring viable populations, which is a different concept, but it...
Than preventing jeopardy, yeah.
It puts you on the different end of the spectrum.
So when you say NIFMA, we mean the National Forest Management Act. Just to put a point on what you were just saying, I've heard it said endlessly that the source of the Northwest Forest Plan was that the genesis of it, of the Northwest Forest Plan, lay in the listing of the northern spotted owl under the Endangered Species Act as a threatened species. But as it actually happened, what the federal court ruled on was this viability rule. So it's actually, in some senses, stronger, as you're saying, than the Endangered Species Act's protections.
Exactly.
So the Forest Service has repeatedly but unsuccessfully tried to write a new rule, with one attempt in 2000 at the end of the Clinton administration, and two more in, I think it was 2004 and 2008 under the second Bush administration. A federal court in San Francisco overturned all those proposed rules, raising to me at least two questions. Why did environmental groups oppose the new rules, and why were the court challenges successful?
So under the Clinton administration, the rules, revision to the rules came out right at the end of his term in 2000. And the problem with those 2000 regulations is they provided the Forest Service with a little bit too much discretion in how they would protect both biological diversity and other resources on the forest, including timber production, right? And one of the problems that, well, what the court found basically is that the rules just simply didn't conform with NIFMA and sent them back. It would have been nice to have some rules that reflected some of the better parts of the 1982 regulations, which included specific enforceable standards that were forest-wide, but that just didn't happen in the 2000. Of course, during the Bush rule, in both instances, there was a major problem in that Bush didn't follow the bedrock environmental laws in this country, the National Environmental Policy Act, which most people talk about it in terms of being a procedural step that you just have to do some process. And of course, Bush did not do any process. So NEPA was violated, and in addition, it violated the Endangered Species Act.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, and I'm talking with Andrew Orahosky, the Conservation Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. So this brings us to the newest proposal for a new National Forest Management Act planning rule, or NIFMA regs, released by the Forest Service, open for comment through May 16th of this year. So what's your take on the new version? Would it improve protections for species and habitats?
Well, on the surface, Scott, there is a lot of lofty language, and a light read of the draft would at least lead the average reader to think that they're actually increasing protections and they're going to do greater things for the forest, for species. The devil, though, is in the details, and what we're really seeing here is more of the same that was offered up by Clinton and even, unfortunately, some of the things that were offered up in the Bush administration. There's a weakening of protections again for the species viability requirement. There's a problem with, you know, our major problem with it is there's no requirement for the best available science. And, you know, without using the best available science in decision making, you're going to have bad decision making. Whatever that decision may end up leading to, it's still going to be a bad decision because you're ignoring all the best knowledge. And the other major obstacle to this is that there's not really, in our view, a good public participation requirement in the forest requirements and forest plans for amendments and for some projects. Basically, the forest could try to shove through a project and give the public a very limited amount of time to comment on it. So, you know, those are the major problems with this new rule.
So I'm hearing it's both in the substance of the proposed rules and in the way it sets up new processes in terms of forest planning. The Forest Service is suggesting, essentially, that it would be better not to have strong, enforceable standards for resource impacts built into its forest plans because the agency will dramatically improve resource management by pursuing what are essentially procedural changes. It often describes these as embracing collaborative planning processes and improving public engagement. Aren't those desirable moves toward democratic process on the part of the agency that manages, 155 national forests and almost 200 million acres public land?
Definitely. We want to see a strong public participation process in all the decision making for the forest, from the top on down to the smaller projects. Public really needs to be consulted early and often, and that's really what the National Environmental Policy Act is all about. The idea that somehow the Forest Service is going to pursue later collaborative planning processes, while it's a lofty goal, a lot of times these things just don't happen. They drag on, and in the interim, what does the Forest Service end up doing? So without specific standards that are enforceable at a project level, you know, we just don't know what the Forest Service is going to propose. And that's what forest plans are about. We have to at least have a management framework. The major problem with not having enforceable standards at the project level is that what we have seen over the past decades is an individual district with an agenda to run roughshod over our environmental protections can propose damaging logging projects with a lot of road building as an amendment or just straight away and get away with it. And that really is an insult to the entire concept of a forest plan, right? So without having these nationwide regulations that tell each forest how to put together a plan, the plan that we get out of any individual forest is going to differ, and it's going to be based on less so on available the best available science and more so on the political convenience of whoever's running the forest or those that have a lot more sway over it.
So after a decade or more of insisting that climate change just wasn't the Forest Service's problem, the agency's begun to grapple with the implications of climate change for these planning and species protection issues we've been talking about. How's the agency addressing this overwhelming issue? And in your view, what should the Forest Service be doing to address the threat of climate change?
The issue of climate change and where our national forests fit in is one that we will be talking about for a long time. The science is clear that the planet is warming and it is having profound impacts, and those impacts are being observed and measured by scientists all around the world, including on our national forests. In some regions, we're seeing the snowpack and glaciers being reduced, river levels going down, and in other areas, we just don't have a clear picture of what the national forest is going to look like given climate change. The Forest Service is taking the angle, at least my understanding is that they're putting forth the national forest as a way to combat climate change. And you know, the concern there is really the trees are going to be growing on the forest regardless of what the Forest Service really does, except for how much logging it does. And the concept of using our national forests as sort of offset for either carbon or other climate concerns is a really dangerous one.
How so?
And that, well, it's dangerous in a sense that, and like I was saying earlier, is the trees are growing there anyway. If we just stop managing the forests, as they call it now, the trees would grow and they would be sequestering carbon and doing their job. The problem is when you want to go in there and remove resources, what is the impact on the landscape? Is that landscape more easily subject to storms or other impacts from the climate changing? Or is that landscape going to continue to be resilient and provide the services that we enjoy from it? This issue is being hotly debated. There are some scientists that essentially say anytime you cut a tree, that you're releasing carbon from the soil because of disturbance, and others are saying that, you know, we should clear cut as much as we can because the wood somehow is going to be sequestered in building and et cetera. Somewhere in between lies this balance where we're at right now, which is some protections, continued resource extraction. And the Forest Service, I think, has been introduced to this concept of climate change, but is in its reaction, it's not really processing what the science is telling the agency to really do, which is to protect our forests because they're a reservoir of species diversity and resilience to climate change. And that really should be part of this process, although it likely warrants a process unto itself, an ongoing one.
Maybe the most important single aspect of that for California is the amount of water that the national forests produce here. Maybe not the most immediate thought that comes to mind here on the North Coast, where we have relatively abundant water supplies, but most of California's water comes out of the Sierra Nevada or most of the urban areas.
Exactly. The importance of national forests that have been, in comparing those that have been logged versus roadless areas, for example, the importance for watersheds and the amount of water being produced. Many communities that have their entire watershed protected for that very purpose of creating water. And right. The connection is pretty strong.
So as you've said, the Forest Service seems to want a rule that gives it the greatest possible freedom to operate, while industrial interests want a rule that makes it more difficult to slow or halt the kind of projects that industry wants, whether it's wide-scale logging, mining, or even recreational development. Some of the observers have suggested a better system would focus less on planning and more on monitoring. In your view, what would a better national forest planning structure look like? What do you think the key points are that aren't present maybe in the current rule?
Well, monitoring is expensive and often doesn't happen because of that. But it is very important. The idea that we can exchange planning for monitoring, I don't necessarily think that that's the right way of putting it. I think that there's a need for planning, and those, you know, the rules that go into place, the standards that we end up having in any particular forest plan, those we have a lot of information about, and those rules can be put in place. There's a lot of consensus in the scientific community about, you know, what that would look like. The types of logging that occur, for example, would likely not allow clear cutting in most forests. It would ensure that, you know, we're looking again at the best available science. It would ensure that we're concerned about water quality and watershed preservation. But the, you know, the monitoring aspect is also very important, and that I think should be certainly addressed in specific standards that would be contained in a forest plan. Monitoring individual species, for example, that may be management indicators. That's been a process that the Forest Service has used in the past with some benefit. It's not to say that those things cannot be changed, but again, it's probably more of a blend of the two rather than just saying we're not going to do any planning.
You are listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson. I'm talking with Andrew Orhosky, Conservation Director of EPIC, about the National Forest Management Act and the Forest Service's new proposed planning rule, which would govern planning of national forest projects and plans. So what's the best way for people to get involved in this process? And if there are key points you haven't already made or you want to reiterate, what would you suggest people say in terms of comments?
Right. Well, you mentioned earlier that the public comment period is open until May 16th. So if you have access to the internet, the Forest Service on their main website has a link to the draft environmental impact statement and the draft planning rule. So I would encourage people to visit that website and get the information directly. In addition, you will be able to find the points on our website. The Environmental Protection Information Center website is www.wildcalifornia.org. The specific points, at least right now, are that we really want to see the Forest Service use the best available science and adopt that language directly into every forest plan. There's a lot of precedent for that as well. Good decisions come out of good science. In addition, we really want to see specific standards set into place that require species viability, that viable populations be maintained across forest. The other major point, I think, and a lot of folks may be familiar with the Northwest Forest Plan, mm-hmm. and this was a science-based process that came out of an update to all the forests in the Northwest. Some of the things in the Northwest Forest Plan that would be useful to include really revolve around watershed protections, the aquatic conservation strategy contained within the Northwest Forest Plan. To have something like that updated, of course, that applies nationwide. You know, those are the main topics that we're sort of covering right now.
So that sort of takes your idea of the best available science and makes it real in a way in terms of here's a specific way that the Forest Service should be using the best available science to protect and actually restore watershed function across the landscape, especially in places where there are key salmon populations or other species that really need it.
Correct. The Northwest Forest Plan was sort of a first step in this process of incorporating the latest science, right, and making it have an impact on the ground.
One of the things that struck me about the forest planning process is kind of unrealistic in terms of Northwestern California is that here in Northwestern California, as you've mentioned, we have this incredible treasure house of natural diversity. And yet we have each of the four forests in the region coming up with its own separate forest plan. It seems like, in a lot of ways, it seems like it would make more sense to think about the four forests of Northwestern California as the biological and geographical entity that they are, and think about putting those plans together in a larger kind of mega plan And I guess that's sort of what the Northwest Forest Plan does on that even larger scale across the, I think it's 18 national forests from the Canadian border down to the Mendocino.
Well, it certainly makes sense for adjacent forests to be talking to each other and managing their lands that in a way that provides support to each forest, right? Without getting into the particulars about a specific place, but I know that there are certainly wilderness areas that go across forest boundaries. There are certainly rivers that go across forest boundaries. And the forests are doing a decent job of coordinating their actions. But to get that coordination a little more set in stone in a forest plan, right? It's not an option to coordinate with your adjacent forest. It's a requirement. And what that requirement really means in setting out the protections for whatever resource you're talking about, whether it be a wild and scenic river or endangered species.
Oh, for example, a roadless area. We lost a roadless area in part because the Shasta Trinity and the Six Rivers were each looking at the small piece they had of what was in effect a larger single roadless area that spanned both forests.
Absolutely. The history of it, I'm sure we could pick out numerous places. And even with the North, even with both forests being part of the Northwest Forest Plan, that fell through the cracks. And, you know, that's really why people need to be engaged. It's why EPIC continues to comment and monitor national forest projects and develop proposals with support of community activists. So I encourage people to find out what's going on their local ranger districts and find out what's going on across the landscape in which they live on all jurisdictions so that they're better informed and can provide decision makers with good ideas about areas such as that, such as a roadless area that we've lost.
Right. So we've run out of time and really want to thank you for coming in. It's a great conversation and we'll be pursuing this further. Any final thoughts, Andrew?
Well, I just encourage folks to make a visit to the EPIC website and comment on the upcoming Forest Service regulations. And it's been a real pleasure to be here today. Thanks.
Excellent. Okay, this has been the Eco News Report. My name's Scott Greeson and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guest today has been Andrew Orahosky, Conservation Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC. You can find them on the web at wildcalifornia.org. You can find the Forest Service's main website at fs.fed.us. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the Public Affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. And many thanks, as ever, to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.